Dateline USA. Darkness in the Northeast. It was nightfall Tuesday along the eastern seaboard of the United States. Millions of commuters in scores of cities descended elevators, moved toward the ritual of rail, bus, or automobile traffic. The daily American exodus from city to suburb had reached its crowded high point, when suddenly all across the darkening Northeast, the lights began to flicker, then die. The elevators slowed to a halt, as did the trains and the tubes. In New York City, the electrical clock stopped at 5:28 p.m., in Boston at 5:25, in Montreal at 5:31. And all across that part of the land where more than 30 million people live, the greatest power failure in history began to change the lives of all. For somewhere in that great network of trunk lines and circuits which carry electricity to more than 80,000 square miles, something as yet unknown ceased to function. And for the millions of persons who did not yet realize the scope of the failure, it was the beginning of a night to remember. The most dramatic stories of this night came from New York City. Voice of America correspondent Cy Freed reports.
It was a quarter past 5 o'clock in the afternoon as a party of tourists, most of them visitors from France and Spain, arrived on the 102nd floor terrace of New York's Empire State Building. From high up there, they had their first general view of the city, a city bathed in a flood of light. Little did they know at the time that there was another spectacle of unparalleled dimension in store for them. It came at 5:28 p.m. In a kind of slow-motion process, the lights all over New York, with the exception of the island borough of Richmond, went out. Startled and with obvious signs of disbelief, the visitors watched the city going dark. The lights went out on every floor of every building. The flaming neon signs eclipsed like vanishing suns. The traffic lights stopped functioning. But New York wasn't a picture of total darkness. The head and tail lights of cars, buses, and trucks formed radiant columns inching their way through streets and avenues. And after a while, the glow of flickering candles appeared behind windows, creating the impression of an early Christmas Eve. This was a picture of New York the visitors from far away had never expected to see. But it was just a picture. What actually happened in the streets of New York and under the surface of the city, they only learned when the elevators started to run again and could take them down from the top of the Empire State. The story of the night of November 9th is a composite of many stories. It is the story of millions of New Yorkers caught in dark offices, in elevators, and in subways and commuter trains that had come to a sudden halt as all electric power failed. Those who reached the streets formed long lines at bus stations, tried to have car owners take them along, or simply decided to make it home by foot if home wasn't too far away. People who couldn't make it, one way or another, spent the night in offices, hotel lobbies, restaurants, nightclubs, theater auditoriums, or in any of the city's armories that were opened to assist stranded New Yorkers. As millions moved through the streets or waited at corners, the actual story of the night of November 9th began to emerge. The story of human behavior under most unusual and complex circumstances.
Somebody has to be held responsible for this. This is the most disastrous thing could be done to the people of the city of New York.
I think that the people have been very kind to one another, that they've acted in gentlemanly fashion, and that one has tried to help the other.
I was down on the lower level. The trains were not running, but the lights were on the platform. And I was there about 15 minutes, and the lights went out completely. And I was down about two levels, but with the aid of matches, we all got out.
No panic.
No panic. And the people were rather pleasant.
about 27 after 5. Total darkness, no electricity, no communication. I finally got a flashlight.
We're with ABC News. What'd you just ask me?
I said, are you going to Brooklyn? I'm just about in tears. I've been out since 6 o'clock. And I just don't know what to do. I've got to get home. Nobody will give me a ride, and I don't know whom to ask.
There's a great exodus starting north in almost all of the principal thoroughfares. Looks like people are abandoning the city. It's people who have gotten so tired that they're going to try to make it by foot, and it's particularly conspicuous on Park Avenue, 8th Avenue, and 5th Avenue.
After the first shock of finding themselves in darkness and partly at places where they didn't want to be, people turned on their own generators of common sense, good humor, and helpfulness. Drivers of cars, buses, and trucks suddenly didn't need traffic lights. Columns stopped at crossings to give others a right of way and only started to move again when others stopped for them. Policemen saw themselves soon assisted by pedestrians who took off their coats so that their light shirts would be recognized and helped in regulating traffic wherever possible. Youngsters assisted elderly people from sidewalk to sidewalk. Others just stood together in groups, talked, or joined voices in some old or new folk songs. And everyone had special praise for the moon, which had decided to turn its full and shining face to the dark city of New York. When finally, at 3:30 in the morning, most of the lights went on and trains and elevators started to move again, city officials were able to report that hardly anyone had been injured and that no acts of vandalism or any major traffic accidents had been registered during the hours of darkness. This, then, is the story that could be told to the group of foreign visitors descending from the top of the Empire State Building, and that we are able to bring to our listeners. This is Cy Freed, Voice of America, New York.
Throughout the northeastern United States, at the moment power began to fail, electrical plant engineers in many cities rushed to separate their urban areas from the great power network or grid system, which links stations in at least 7 states. Now this grid system was dramatically failing for some unknown reason. Instinctive reaction at that moment told electrical controllers from Philadelphia to Montreal to get off the regional net and revert to local power. In most cities, there simply was not enough time, as National Broadcasting Company reporter Jeffrey Pond learned from Charles Hopping of New York's Consolidated Edison.
Fortunately, the cutoff did not come quick enough. As I say, this happened very quickly, in a matter of a few seconds, this sudden change in the situation. And as a result, our whole electrical system here in New York City, Westchester County, and out on Long Island Lighting Company territory had become unstable. Essentially, it's like a big flywheel that had been going along at a very good speed, and then it slowed down, and because of an extra load put on it, and that load not getting off quick enough, the flywheel kept slowing down. And the more it slowed down, the worse the situation got, to the point where there was nothing for the equipment on our system, in our generating stations, to do but stop, and it stopped. And with the result, we didn't have power for most of the city of New York.
But once the various stations had stopped, they weren't putting out any more juice, why couldn't they simply be switched on again and the juice start flowing again?
Well, it's not quite as easy as that. In a generating station, you have to be able to move fuel, you have to be able to grind coal, you have to be able to pump air into the furnaces, you have to be able to pump water through the furnaces, you have to be able to pump water in from the rivers to cool the condensers. All of these auxiliary motors and fans require electricity. Without them, you can't run the boiler.
Had any contingency plans ever been made for a sudden collapse of this kind?
Oh, yes. This is why you have interconnections, and for instance, why the interconnection with public service was of such use to us between Staten Island and New Jersey. and that it helped us keep one station on the line and thereby helped us get our other stations back on the line.
Charles Hopping of New York's Consolidated Edison Company speaking with NBC correspondent Jeffrey Pond. At the United Nations, just up the East River from the Con Edison plant, afternoon sessions were just finishing when the blackout came. Voice of America correspondent Richard Walton was there.
Just before 5:30 Tuesday night, the lights at the United Nations began slowly to dim, like the house lights in a theater just before the performance begins. Then suddenly they went out, and shouts, more amused than startled, sounded along the corridors. Across the East River, shimmering black under the full moon, the lights of the Borough of Queens went out. The only lights were those of automobiles crossing the Queensborough and Williamsburg bridges, and those of the ships tied up along the river. Inside the United Nations, the dark was impenetrable until security guards got flashlights and lit the moving stairs, now, of course, no longer moving. The work of the United Nations ended abruptly. Those afternoon meetings that had not yet ended concluded without benefit of the chairman's gavel. Earphones for the simultaneous translations went dead, and that was that. The diplomats and the secretariat people began to grope their way out of the building by flashlight where there was any, but by touch where there was not. And like the rest of the city, the United Nations began to improvise. Until a small generator could be obtained for the lobby of the secretariat building, a truck was driven up and its headlights shined inside. Security guards began to pull trapped people out of elevators. And some people, who eventually came to realize that they could not get home, began to seek soft places to sleep. And until the pre-dawn hours when light was restored, dark shadows could be detected slumped on chairs and sofas. By Wednesday morning, the UN was back at work, but not quite as usual. The mass of documents, usually printed overnight by anonymous people, were not in their racks. No one was quite sure which committee was meeting, where, or when. But sooner or later, people found out, although the main topic of conversation, for the time being at least, was not the world issues before the UN, but the blackout that had handicapped New York, but for some reason had not halted it. Richard Walton, Voice of America, reporting from the United Nations.
For thousands of persons flying toward New York City on Wednesday night, the largest metropolis in this country presented an eerie mask of darkness. Passengers in hundreds of planes were told that they would be rerouted to Philadelphia as they gazed down on lightless New York. NBC reporter Bernard Chessman reports from Philadelphia International Airport.
For many of the thousands who came to Philadelphia last night and early this morning, this city had been only a name on a map or a town they read about in their history books. They came unexpectedly by jet or propeller-driven aircraft to this city's international airport, and their presence was felt immediately. The crush of lines, the endless waits for hotels, phones, restaurants, and for many a drink. The city is not normally a large entry point for foreign travelers, but in the last 12 hours it became the capital. Most flights from Kennedy International in New York and LaGuardia were detoured this way, and this pressed the already undermanned customs service. Officials called back every available worker and set up additional workspace for the inspection of baggage and the collection of duty fees. Most of the travelers seemed puzzled at the change in plans. Many seemed anxious for relatives who were supposed to meet them at other airports. And a few seasoned travelers took it all in stride. But generally, it produced what appeared to be never-ending queues at airline counters, which in itself produced seemingly never-ending questions of the workers manning those stations. How the passengers generally responded was best summed up by TWA stewardess Michelle Levan. She spoke with KYW-TV reporter Trudy Haynes moments after the landing.
I think it was, we were all more in shock of the whole situation than anything else. But most of the passengers did. They all reacted quite well, and they took it as they would anything else.
Were you able to see the blackout in New York at all?
Yes, we saw portions. We were about 3,000 feet. We saw portions of the city that were lighted and then portions that were cut off. Now, I think it went all the way down to the Long Island Sound. There was a portion of the Long Island Sound that was lighted up, and then the rest of the city was black.
The biggest problem during the early morning hours was finding a way of getting all the people out of the airport and into their overnight places of lodging. Limousine and taxi service was quadrupled, as many of the airlines reserved blocks of rooms in the city's hotels for the many travelers too weary to face the challenge of finding ground transportation back to New York, Boston, Providence, Albany, or a score of other eastern cities. The airlines also ran shuttle buses to the hotels, and this morning are in the midst of a reverse shuttle back to the airport, as travelers are now able to complete or continue their trips. This is Bernard Chessman, KYW-TV News in Philadelphia.
It was, of course, a catastrophic blackout, darkening the lives of more than 30 million people in the most industrialized area of the United States. The question arose immediately in the minds of most Americans: how has the United States defense network withstood the power failure? And the answer was, very well indeed. NBC Pentagon correspondent Peter Hackus reports.
At most of the key military installations in the blackout area, you wouldn't have known there was a power failure unless you had looked out the window and seen the rest of the community in darkness. Emergency generating systems went into operation automatically at most locations with hardly even a flicker of the lights. The first thing the military services did, of course, was to run a complete check of all their facilities in the blackout region, a checkout which produced reassuring reports that emergency power systems had in fact taken over. Perhaps the most sensitive locations, the Strategic Air Command bases where jet bombers are on a constant ready alert, were functioning perfectly throughout the blackout period. All of the missile warning systems, even those remotely connected with the blackout area, were checked out instantly and found all of them to be working perfectly. At the Pentagon, the top secret command posts for each of the services continued to function without interruption, as did all of the military communication lines. The hotline between Washington and Moscow was open continuously. It was a tremendous inconvenience for more than 30 million Americans, but to the military and for civil defense, which is now run by the Army, it was a good operational test. Peter Hackus, NBC News, Washington.
Although the blackout, luckily, had caused no major disasters, the serious questions regarding the cause of the power failure remained to be explored. And the man who demanded immediate exploration was the President of the United States. VOA White House correspondent James Yankauer reports.
President Johnson, like every other citizen in the nation, wanted to know why. He, however, had the power to do something about it. Within hours after learning about the Northeast power blackout, the president had ordered an immediate investigation of the freak happening to be headed by the chairman of the Federal Power Commission, Joseph Swidler. The president offered Mr. Swidler the support of every agency of government, including the Department of Defense and the Federal Bureau of Investigation. The president first learned of the massive blackout from his car radio while riding on a ranch road near his Texas home. It was the top item on a 6 o'clock news program to which he had tuned. Immediately, he telephoned from his car to talk to officials in Washington, getting further information and assurances that there was no interruption to defense services in the nation. By Wednesday morning, when the Power Commission investigation was underway, the Defense Department, the Office of Emergency Planning, the Commerce Department, and still more agencies had started investigations primarily within their own limited jurisdictions. Congressional leaders also promised that the appropriate House of Representatives and Senate committees would have their questions to be answered, too. Wednesday evening came with a great many investigations asking a great many questions, but not getting very many answers. There was no indication that the massive power failure was anything but a freak accident. Power Commission Chairman Swidler said the true beginnings of the accident may never be found. he did promise a preliminary report to the president by week's end. Whatever the cause may be, President Johnson had been in constant touch with developments in the various investigations, and if an answer can be found, the president will be the first to know why. This is James Yankauer in Washington.
President Johnson's order to the Federal Power Commission to conduct an immediate investigation of the Northeast power failure was acted on quickly. How the investigation began was explained to NBC reporter Steve Nevis by William Dean, head of the FPC's Interconnection and Coordination Committee.
With a partial explanation was the Federal Power Commission's head of Interconnection and Coordination, William Dean. We first asked him how the commission will go about finding out what happened.
I believe that the people are here on the staff are trying to get in touch with the various utility organizations that are involved. This finally winds up with the people on the job there that have the best ideas as to what has actually happened. And I think that there seems to be some disagreement among them as to what has happened. What is the causes of things like this are really usually pretty difficult to determine. There's a lot of excitement, lots of trouble. Every man is trying to solve problems of his own particular load, and so it's pretty hard for everybody to understand just exactly what is going on.
Mr. Dean, some of the experts in the power area have suggested that an intertie system comparable to that which is being constructed now in the Pacific Northwest would resolve a problem like this and would prevent a major power failure in a heavily populated area. Is this true?
This is a hard one to answer. I don't think that you can ever take enough steps to protect against every possible contingency. We do the things that we think will meet the difficulties that we foresee, but it's always possible for a difficulty that you didn't foresee to come up.
Stephen Nevis, NBC News.
The actual cause of this massive power failure may be a long time coming, but the memories of a dark night are now ever present. In Boston, in Montreal, in Hartford, and in many other cities, there are millions of people who will continue to ask one another, "Where were you the night the lights went out?" The deputy chief of the Voice of America's New York Bureau, Eddie Goldberger, is one of those people.
When the lights went out at approximately 5:25 last night, they didn't really go out bang like that. It wasn't a sudden thing. Actually, what happened was that they dimmed first. People looked up and said, "What's wrong with the light?" They came up, they died away again, and then finally they went out. And as far as we were concerned, the lights had gone out and the power had failed in the building. It was only when we got a call from our United Nations correspondent over at the United Nations building to say that something was wrong with the lights over at the UN that we began to realize that this was bigger than simply a power failure in the building. And then one of the members of the staff looked out the window, and there was New York. You could dimly see it. You could see the building standing against the sky, but you couldn't see any lights, except here and there, like the Polyclinic Hospital, where they had an auxiliary power supply. Here and there, the lights shone. And of course, the one big source of light in the city were the automobiles. 8th Avenue, which runs directly past our building, was a ribbon of lights as far as we could see down the avenue. So bright, in fact, that it cast shadows against the walls in the offices in which we work. Nobody knew exactly what had happened, but it was obvious by this time that the power had failed in New York. And so, like, I guess, most of New York, we resorted to our radios, only to find, first, that the power had failed in the radio stations also. Within a short time, however, our transistor radios, the few that we had here in the studios, in the offices in New York, the transistor radios began to pick up first one radio station, then another, until finally almost the whole spectrum, almost the whole spectrum of New York's between 16 and 20 radio stations were back on the air to tell us that this was a power failure, that it wasn't the kind of catastrophe that some of us had envisioned, but somewhere, somehow, the power had failed in all of New York City. Obviously, the elevators weren't running. It's 16 flights of stairs from here to the street, and all we could do at that point was, in a sense, to sit back and enjoy it, if you can call enjoying it, worrying about how you were going to get home, how long it was going to be before the lights came back on again, and all the other things that you worry about at a time like that. Over the next couple of hours, we put together some lights out of electric batteries that we had here for flashlights. We dug out all the flashlights we had. And gradually, as the thing began to take shape, we began to think about possibly going home, those of us who could manage one way or another to get home. We organized two safari groups out of the New York office. The first group of about six or seven took a flashlight and left the offices at about 7 o'clock to climb down the 16 flights of stairs and try to make their way somehow or other, either home or to stay with friends or whatever arrangements they could make. The second and final group left at about 7:30, also to go down the stairs and out and take their various ways from there. I was in that second group, so I can tell you that we had a pencil flashlight, and we had a small makeshift light, which we had put together with four flashlight batteries, rather precariously wired together, and a flashlight bulb. We couldn't solder the wires, so they were simply put on with tape, attached to the outlets with tape. We found, however, as we went down the stairs, that at various places along the stairway, there were people stationed with flashlights. The two telephone men who work in the building at one floor, a man who normally works on the elevators at another floor, and one of the other maintenance men further down, so that there really wasn't too much of a problem in climbing down what should have been, but were not, dark stairways.
Eddie Goldberger of the Voice of America's New York Bureau with some reflections on the great power failure which darkened the Northeast on Tuesday night. And so now, as President Johnson has said, the effort is to find the cause of this historic blackout and to prevent its reoccurrence. The irony of this massive power failure was pointed up on Tuesday night in a speech by U.S. Navy Vice Admiral Hyman Rickover, who, unaware of the blackout at the moment, had written into his talk to the Federal Power Commission, "If I could have only one material gift, I would want it to be electric light." This has been Dateline USA, Darkness in the Northeast. And this is Jack Cannon speaking from the Washington studios of the Voice of America.
This is the Voice of America broadcasting in the 16-meter band on 17.78 megacycles, in the 19-meter band on 15.21 and 15.29 megacycles, in the 25-meter band on 11.96 megacycles, in the 31-meter band on 9.76 megacycles, in the 41-meter band on 7.11, 7.13, and 7.20 megacycles, and in the 75-meter band on 3.98 megacycles.